From late 1943, the Luftwaffe began to prioritize protecting German cities and German industry over protecting the battlefronts. Given also that the prospective battlefront in the west already had priority over the existing battlefront in the east, the Luftwaffe's decision meant that, by the end of 1943, 70% of German fighter aircraft were being committed to the skies over Germany or the west. Moreover, the strategic bombing of Germany compelled the Germans to commit 80% of their flak weaponry against it over the course of the war. And if Speer's post-war claims are to be believed, the V-2 rocket, a weapon system so expensive that the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey calculated its cost as equivalent to that of 24,000 aircraft, was intended primarily as an avenging morale booster to a German population suffering under Allied area bombing. Meanwhile, the sum effect of destruction of factories, relocation of factories to escape bombing, diversion of factory workers to repair tasks, and destruction of aluminium production was to prevent between 5,000 and 6,000 aircraft from being built in 1943. In the skies themselves, meanwhile, fuel shortages and necessarily truncated training times compelled the Luftwaffe to churn out ill-trained, half-baked pilots, who not only faced experienced and proficient Allied and Soviet airmen, but also lost many of their own number to pilot error. The German frontline soldier facing the Red Army felt the effect of threadbare air cover directly. The Russian attacks in strong waves every day with tanks and fighter aircraft, wrote Unteroffizier Julfried K. of the 25th Panzer Grenadier Division, the redesignated 25th Motorized Infantry Division, on 8 September 1943. Before all that, he lays down an unbelievable artillery benediction on our positions. That destroys the nerves. Just awful. Moreover, with its improving, if still evolving, grasp of maneuver warfare, the Red Army was learning to exploit the depths of the country, surprising German forces with the speed of its advance. This helped compensate for its ongoing weaknesses, particularly the still uneven quality of its officers and NCOs. It remained a painful, costly learning curve. Brutal discipline continued to play its part in maintaining the troops' combat effectiveness, as did generous rations of vodka. But so immense was the Red Army's offensive power now becoming that it could grind down the Germans in smaller consecutive operations aimed at different points of the Eastern Front. The Germans could still move troops from point to point and deny the Red Army a decisive breakthrough, but in the long run they would exhaust themselves before the Red Army exhausted itself. The army was on the defensive not just militarily, but also institutionally, for it was contending with an ever greater portion of armor production being siphoned off to the Waffen-SS. Between the autumn of 1943 and the summer of 1944, the Waffen-SS Panzer Grenadier Divisions were redesignated as Panzer Divisions. By June 1944, the Waffen-SS had 7 Panzer Divisions, still far short of the army's 23, but narrowing the gap nonetheless. The army had to get used to growing competition from the Waffen-SS for men as well as materiel. Hitler allowed the Waffen-SS, not the army, to raise volunteer units from the Germanic peoples of occupied Europe. This, of course, boosted the ability of the Waffen-SS to raise units faster than the army, which in turn became another of its attributes that impressed Hitler greatly. The dictator was forgetting, of course, that new recruits took a long time to train. Here at least, then, Hitler stood guilty of Manstein's post-war charge that he did not take training seriously enough. A quiet yet momentous change in the status of the Waffen-SS came about at the end of 1942. Until then, recommendations for awarding military decorations to officers were based on the candidate's character and military performance. But from the end of 1942, such recommendations were also to list both a candidate's peacetime occupation and his father's occupation. This information went straight into the mini-biographies of award recipients that were printed in the newspapers. As the officer corps of the Waffen-SS was socially broader than the army's, this change enabled the Waffen-SS to trumpet its officer corps as a truer reflection of the Volksgemeinschaft. Further, as the Waffen-SS relied increasingly upon non-volunteers and non-Germans and diluted its elite status, Himmler sought to compensate by intensifying the indoctrination to which the new recruits were to be subjected. If the expanding Waffen-SS was in danger of watering down its elite status, Himmler believed that ideological fervor was one respect in which it could always steal a march on the army. The army's ambivalent view of the Waffen-SS, rivals on the one hand, useful military material on the other, grew more ambivalent still during 1943 and early 1944. Whether because they were increasingly anxious to limit the losses among their own troops, or because they bought into the image of the Waffen-SS as an elite fire brigade, army field commanders could be wasteful of Waffen-SS formations when they had operational command of them. Such was the fate of the SS Panzer Grenadier Division Viking in August 1943, when 40 corps sent it off on a pointless, costly counterattack against a Soviet bridgehead over the River Donets. Rank-and-file army soldiers sneered at Waffen-SS troops on account of the camouflage smocks they wore by deriding them as tree frogs. Yet despite this, and the fact that they also often viewed Waffen-SS men as cocksure and arrogant, they acknowledged their fighting worth. Corporal Werner F. of the 12th Panzer Division, for instance, praised the fighting performance of the Waffen-SS over the winter of 1941-1942. "We have great respect for these men who were assigned to the hot spots up here, there were plenty of those in the winter, and who always held out. In terms of manpower, material, and spirit, they are an elite troop, and have proved it 100 times." At the other end of the command scale, Hermann Balk, now a general of Panzer troops, later recalled a soldier's night out that he arranged for 200 men of his 48 Panzer Corps in January 1944, at which the atmosphere became a little touchy when the troops of the 1st SS Panzer Division and the 7th Panzer Division decided to settle the question of which of the two divisions was better. But that situation was eventually resolved with a friendly handshake. And as the war continued, more and more army officers took inspiration from Obergruppenführer Hauser's early example and transferred to the Waffen-SS themselves. Although they had to prove their ideological conviction to have any chance of being allowed to join, careerism rather than ideological conviction was their main motive, for the smaller size of the Waffen-SS offered the prospect of faster promotion. Furthermore, even though the Army Officer Corps grew more socially diverse as the war went on, men who were not from its traditional recruitment circles could still expect to get on more rapidly in the Waffen-SS. For the same reason, many Army NCOs were also attracted to joining. They could expect particularly rapid advancement if they had served their entire 12 years as a Reichswehr NCO, and such men became particularly commonplace at the levels of Sturmbannführer and Obersturmbannführer. By the war's end, a quarter of the Brigadeführer and Gruppenführer in the Waffen-SS had spent at least 3 years in the Reichswehr, the Austrian Bundesheer, or the Wehrmacht. The mix of rivalry and cooperation between the army and the SS and police was also apparent in the occupied rear. Following the peak of the mass murder of Soviet Jews in 1941, the SS and police spent much of 1942 earmarking for annihilation the numerous pockets of remaining Jews in army-controlled areas. Rear area army commanders continued to endorse their efforts, even if they did not wish to see regular army troops directly participating, and they furnished the SS with considerable help from the GFP. In the Ukraine, for instance, GFP Group 721 sent out regular patrols that swept up numerous persons suspected of bandit activity, a particularly large number of Jews among them. As a rule, these deny their Jewish origin. In most cases, a physical examination disproves their claims. From the second half of 1942, Hitler expanded the security role of the SS and police in the East. Its ferocious approach to security, he believed, was the surest means of stemming the growth of the partisan movement. Here, as across the Third Reich generally, then, brutality brought rewards in manpower and in material resources, and if the army were not to lose out in this contest, then it also needed to be brutal. This, too, may help explain the plethora of ruthless directives that many of the army's anti-partisan units issued during 1942 and 1943, and the resulting colossal body counts. Like the Waffen-SS at the front, however, the SS and police in the rear not only rivaled the army's anti-partisan effort, but also assisted it. In the Army Group rear areas, and, less commonly, in the Army rear areas, the Einsatzgruppen and the Order Police provided extra manpower for anti-partisan operations. Indeed, Order Police battalions provided full combat units. Einsatzkommandos and Sonderkommandos provided intelligence for anti-partisan operations by employing local informers to identify hostile villages. They also often acted as judge, jury, and, with the approval of the army commander leading the operation, executioner, screening partisan prisoners, accomplices, and suspects, and eliminating those whom they believed warranted it. In August 1942, Hitler's Directive No. 46 made the OKH responsible for anti-partisan warfare in the army-administered zone and the SS and police responsible in the Reich Commissariats. Soldiers on the ground recognized the military contribution the SS made to the anti-partisan campaign, with Lieutenant Helmut H. of the 258th Infantry Division writing in September 1942, "The partisan infestation must be really bad at the moment, for sometimes the successful rail detonations left and right of the track could be seen in the form of destroyed and overturned locomotives and wagons. The SS will clean them out good." SS anti-partisan doctrine was embodied in the concept of Bandenbekämpfung, or combating of bandits. Indeed, in August 1942, Himmler ordered that the term bandit replace the term partisan in official SS directives and correspondence. This change in terminology reflected the SS view that partisans and the populations that supported them were not military opponents seeking to liberate their territory from foreign invaders. Himmler regarded such territory as not just land to be exploited for the war effort, but also as Lebensraum for German settlers. He considered the partisans to be criminal, Jewish-led vermin, to be cleansed mercilessly from the land. Such an attitude chimed with the German army's harsh anti-guerrilla sentiments then, but also invoked the full ideological ambition of the Nazis' resettlement plans for the East. The anti-partisan operations that the SS and police inflicted upon the occupied Soviet Union were unsurpassed in their savagery and bloodletting. And on one occasion, an army unit participated directly in SS and police anti-partisan efforts in the Reich Commissariats. Between 20 May and 23 June 1943, Operation Cottbus took place in a region straddling the civilian-administered General Commissariat of White Ruthenia and the Army Group Center rear area, and rear area command thus committed the 286th Security Division to the operation. Among the anti-partisan operations on Soviet soil, Christian Gerlach has called Cottbus the most awful extermination campaign of them all. Nearly 10,000 people were killed in the operation, 6,000 transported for labor, and another 2,000 to 3,000 set to defusing mines. The ascent of the SS and police and the conduct of security across occupied Europe was further confirmed when, in June 1943, Hitler appointed Himmler Chef der Bandenbekämpfung, Chief of Anti-Bandit Combat. Himmler, in turn, appointed the one-time senior SS and police leader for Army Group Center, Erich von dem Bach-Zelewski, to the post of Chef der Bandenkampfverbände, Chief of Anti-Bandit Formations. Bach-Zelewski now assumed the chief coordinating and commanding role in anti-partisan warfare across the Nazi Empire. By the summer of 1943, with the Eastern Front moving inexorably westwards, civilians who had collaborated with the German occupiers panicked at the prospect of the Red Army's return. Most civilians in German-held territory, however, were now not only embittered by the depredations of their occupiers, but also well aware that the Germans were losing the war. Under these conditions, no amount of German ferocity could hope even to stem the further growth of the partisan movement. Indeed, it could only alienate the population further. Despite Bach-Zelewski's new appointment, the army retained operational control of the anti-partisan campaign in its army rear areas and army group rear areas. Generally, brutal though they so often were, army-led operations remained considerably less so than SS-led operations. Indeed, in August 1943, the OKW finally acknowledged that there was more value in winning hearts and minds, ordering that captured partisans, deserters or otherwise, should be taken prisoner rather than shot. But any effect such saner measures might have had in winning over partisans and placating civilians was undercut by the German war economy's unquenchable demands. For 1943 saw the high point of dead zone operations, a new and terrible nexus of anti-partisan warfare and economic plunder. This caused bandit areas to be laid to waste, their livestock and crops seized, their able-bodied populations enslaved for labor in the Reich, and the remaining population interned or sometimes killed. There had been prototype examples of such operations during 1942, one of the cruelest being the 707th Infantry Division's Operation Bamberg in April of that year. The real start of the Dead Zone campaign, however, was heralded by Göring's directive of 26 October. When combating partisans and clearing partisan-infested areas, all livestock to hand is to be removed to a safe area, and the food reserves likewise cleared away to deprive the partisans of them. The entire male and female workforce that may be liable for labor service is to be forcibly recruited and taken to the plenipotentiary for labor, to be used either in the rear areas or the homeland. Children are to be specially accommodated in camps to the rear. The Germans treated those dwindling rear areas they still controlled with a degree of consideration. Those they did not control, they devastated. Some German counterinsurgency operations of the First World War had employed this approach, but on nothing like this scale. Plundering bandit areas also served the political purpose of having more food to distribute to those areas the Germans still controlled. Wirtschaftsinspektion Center was one of numerous economic agencies that believed that redistributing such plunder could alleviate hunger and maintain order across the rear areas. But dead zone operations were a late, particularly rapacious spasm of an occupation policy in terminal decline. Proof of this was that the operations did nothing to assuage the continuing growth of the partisan movement. By the summer of 1943, the movement was also spreading in the Ukraine and northwest Russia. Partisan numbers across the German rear leapt from 130,000 in January 1943 to 250,000 in September. Like that of the Yugoslav partisans, there is a danger of exaggerating the military impact of the Soviet partisans. In particular, they rarely preoccupied high-quality German combat formations for very long. Nevertheless, they did tie down troops that the Germans might have used for purposes other than combat. From the summer of 1943 onwards, moreover, they severely disrupted the Germans' ability to move troops by rail. In particular, partisans in the Army Group Center area destroyed 20,000 sections of railway line between July, synchronized with the Red Army's effort against Operation Citadel, and November 1943. The spread of partisan attacks against the railway network across the occupied Soviet Union was attested to by the emergency measures reportedly used by the 281st Security Division in the Army Group North rear area in April 1944. All stretches of terrain close to the railways were to have one sentry every 100 yards. In open terrain, every 200 yards. Sentries were to remain within sight of one another. As a comment on the throttling effect that rising partisan activity was now having upon the German security effort, the last line of the division's report could not have been clearer. These security schedules were not to be deviated from even if the last man of the division was used. As control of the rear areas progressively slipped from the army's grasp, so did its fortunes at the front continue to plummet. Model's salvaging of the Hagen position in August 1943 had brought some temporary respite north of the former Kursk salient. The German armies south of it, however, were soon in peril. If the Third Battle of Kharkov was arguably Field Marshal von Manstein's greatest victory, the much larger Battle of the Ukraine that now unfolded was undoubtedly his greatest defeat. The fighting lasted from August 1943 through to April 1944. There were some inspired counter-thrusts, courtesy most famously of General Bulk's 48 Panzer Corps. Indeed, the performance of Bulk's troops recalled the old-style maneuver warfare of the Panzer divisions at their best. Almost all linear and stubbornly defended positions in World War II were penetrated, Bulk asserted after the war. The defense, therefore, had to be conducted in a mobile and offensive manner, so that the two most precious weapons, initiative and surprise, remained in your own hands and not the enemy's. Overall, however, Army Group South's performance in the course of the Ukraine battles showed that the Germans could no longer delude themselves that their operational performance was superior to the Red Army's. Manstein underestimated the Soviets' cunning when he allowed his armor to be drawn to counter a Soviet offensive on the River Meuse. Simultaneously, the Soviets launched an offensive to destroy German forces directly south of the Kursk salient. Manstein now realized he had been duped and resent his panzer divisions further south. The Germans eventually re-established a defensive line and checked the Red Army, but not without enduring further grievous losses of troops and territory. Again, Hitler showed some strategic sense. He allowed Manstein to dissolve the now pointless Kuban bridgehead, retreat part way through the Ukraine, and establish a new defensive line on the River Dnieper. However, with the Soviets committing five army groups to driving them out of the Ukraine entirely, the Germans could not hope to hold the Dnieper. "The devil has been let loose among us," wrote Lance Corporal Helmut P. of the 198th Infantry Division. "The Russian is trying with all means to set foot on the West Bank. The ultimate material battle is in progress. I have much to do, for every day and night the wounded pour in. Yes, this is the quiet position that we had looked forward to for so long." The Soviets were across the river by early October, and in Kiev little more than a month later. The Red Army's capture of Kiev, which saw General Hoth sacked from his command of the 4th Panzer Army, exemplified how far the Red Army had come in mastering the operational art of the offensive. Rather than attack the well-defended sector just below Kiev, Red Army command reinforced a small foothold north of the city in swampy terrain that the Germans never considered a viable jumping-off point. It built up its forces in this foothold under the utmost secrecy. Then, on 1 November, the Red Army attacked below Kiev. The Germans, assuming this to be the main focus of its attack, sent mobile reserves to counter. 2 days later, the Soviet 38th Army burst out of its swampy bridgehead to devastating effect against the much weaker German defenses now facing it. As a feat of misdirection, it rivaled Army Group B's diversionary drive through the Low Countries in May 1940 in pursuit of Manstein's sickle-cut plan. The field marshal had been shot with his own gun. The 4th Mountain Division and the 198th Infantry Division, like many other formations, were devastated by the Ukraine battles. In November, the 4th Mountain Division described the chaotic spectacle of its retreat west of Militopol. "The only usable road is hopelessly blocked by fleeing motorized and horse-drawn baggage. To an extent, the picture is one of the wildest panic and the greatest disorganization. The main reason for this chaos is that marching next to the road is impossible because it is flanked by quicksand. If the enemy attacks strongly under these conditions, as before, the effect upon the already disorganized baggage will be catastrophic." Between 10 July and 30 September, the 198th Infantry Division lost nearly 10,000 men. In March 1944, while also facing the miseries of the spring thaw, it was virtually destroyed all over again. "We've had to fight the hardest battles that ever there were," wrote Helmut P. on 16 March. "Mud and filth were even bigger enemies. We went barefoot through the mud. 6 days ago, the division was completely shattered. I got out of it by a miracle. The whole headquarters with everything around it fell, including the colonel." Despite further German efforts, such as a costly breakout from the Cherkasy pocket, by April 1944 the Red Army had cleared the Germans from the Ukraine, including the Crimea. Developments in the Crimea were another occasion on which Hitler showed some flexibility, albeit at the very last minute, by ordering the peninsula evacuated. He also ordered down Colonel General Schörner from Army Group North with 3 corps to stabilize the situation. The Red Army's forces now halted to replenish their strength and wait out the spring Rasputitsa. They had already done their job. The Germans were out of the Ukraine and back on the Romanian frontier, and Army Group South had been cleaved in two. Losing the Ukraine brought Field Marshal von Manstein's time to an end. Hitler had already run out of patience with him by late 1943, remarking after Manstein had proposed another strategic withdrawal and counterattack that the Field Marshal should not speak of a counter-operation but call it by the right name, running away. Manstein had only lasted as long as he had because the crisis in the East was so desperately urgent, but Hitler finally sacked him in March. Manstein's doctrine of flexible defense might work locally if executed by a reasonably resourced formation such as General Bulk's 48 Panzer Corps, but strategically it was bankrupt. The withdrawals Manstein had advocated would only have meant something if they had bought the Germans time to marshal forces for the kind of effort that might postpone the Reich's defeat indefinitely. Strain their sinews as they might, however, neither German industry nor the Wehrmacht itself could achieve such a decisive effort. Realistically, Hitler's focus on rigid defense could do no more than delay the inevitable either. That said, it was not so doctrinaire or deranged as some generals' post-war memoirs claimed. For one thing, Hitler did not always adhere to it strictly. Further, it had a logic that, though unrealistic, was at least straightforward. By holding on to territory, Hitler believed, the Germans would not only stave off defeat, but also retain a launch pad for future offensives. And it was no worse a solution to Germany's strategic ills than what Manstein and the maneuver generals had been proposing. Nor, however, was it any better. It had worked, temporarily, before Moscow during the winter of 1941-1942, but that was before the Soviets outnumbered the Germans by at least 5-1 in certain sectors of the front. As Manstein himself rightly observed after the war, "We confronted a hydra. For every head cut off, 2 new ones appeared to grow." Furthermore, Hitler based his doctrine of rigid defense on the idea that the German soldier was still better trained and better led than his Red Army opponent. That was a contentious statement at best by late 1943, and even if it were true, the gap was closing rapidly. The ultimate bankruptcy of rigid defense was exposed when the Germans had to abandon 10 Ukrainian towns and cities that Hitler had designated fortified places. That said, the Germans defended the Eastern Front's central and northern sectors more successfully than they did its southern sector. Kiev's fall and a Soviet breakthrough at Nevel shook Army Group Center's southern flank, but its formations were able to fall back cohesively and establish a firm defensive position further west, centered on Vitebsk, Orsha, Mogilev, and Bobruisk, with the swamps of Polesia covering its southern flank. It was pinned down and unable to aid its comrades further, but at least held its new line until June 1944. Army Group North, however, was hard-pressed, still more so when it was forced to relinquish many of its troops to the more southerly army groups. In January 1944, the Soviets relieved Leningrad and simultaneously attacked the 18th Army before Field Marshal von Küchler could organize an orderly withdrawal to a new defensive line, the Panther position. Hitler initially refused to allow Küchler to withdraw, sacked him, and replaced him temporarily with Model. In March 1944, Model assumed command of Army Group North Ukraine and was replaced in turn as commander of Army Group North by Colonel General Georg Lindemann. But after Soviet partisan forces joined the attack and the Germans lost a vital railway junction, Hitler suddenly decided that withdrawing to the Panther position made sense after all. Army Group North resisted fiercely along the Panther line, and the early spring thaw and the region's swampy, forested terrain made it easier to defend. By the spring of 1944, Army Group South had been split into Model's Army Group North Ukraine and Schirner's Army Group South Ukraine. Both men were hard-bitten commanders, well-versed in resilient defense. Schirner, in particular, combined a fanatical National Socialist faith with a brutal determination to terrorize his men into fighting on. The latter characteristic would become increasingly clear over time. His real capabilities in defensive warfare were already apparent, as an order of 29 May 1944 shows. Schirner issued the order following an ignominious collapse by the 91st Mountain Regiment against a Soviet breakthrough, during which the troops had abandoned several villages, according to Schirner, in cowardly flight. As well as railing against the senior commanders whom he held responsible, Schirner outlines what he believed went wrong and the practical measures he believes could have remedied the situation. He expresses his undying faith in the superiority of the German soldier. Moreover, though he acknowledges the fighting qualities of the Red Army, his racial contempt for it is clear. The order offers a good insight into the German army's approach to defensive warfare during the long retreat in the East, and is thus worth citing at some length. How the Bolshevik digs himself into the ground, how he digs himself in the shortest time a deep defense system with countless blocking positions. Whenever he takes a village, he holds it, and we have to take it back with the harshest fighting. What was going on with the attacking reserve in the area north of Korieva? Nothing had been prepared, and no one among the responsible commanders got a grip to try and control the chaos that was reigning, bringing all the demoralized men together and get them standing again. And I stand by this. There is no desperate situation, just desperate men, and to that group belongs no decent German soldier. Quiet fronts are dangerous fronts. Some seem to forget that calm can be deceptive and is only a pause in a bitter war that the Bolshevik is preparing with all his might. The greatest Soviet flood has yet to break forth, and already the enemy has broken through with complete surprise in one place. Only enthusiasm in work and fanaticism in the fight guarantees us victory, which, in the words of the Führer, will belong to those who put into the battle the purest will, the most steadfast belief, and the most fanatical resolve. The German army's retreat through the Ukraine and its withdrawals further north inflicted a final paroxysm of misery on the occupied population, more indiscriminate than any the German army had dealt out before. Wirtschaftsstab Ost ordered that every individual is duty-bound to ensure that the enemy gains no military or economic use from the abandoned region for the foreseeable future. By late 1943, the Germans, and still more so the Soviets, had widely employed scorched-earth measures during the Eastern Campaign. The Germans had used them during the winter of 1941 to 1942, and again during more limited withdrawals in the northern and central sectors in early 1943. What they unleashed between the summer of 1943 and the spring of 1944, however, eclipsed any of their previous efforts. Ulfried K., writing on 28 September 1943, described scenes from the apocalypse as the Germans razed settlement after settlement to the ground. "We are rolling every day. Retreat through Smolensk. Everything is in rubble and ashes. Wagons along the whole route laden with baggage. Wretched scenes, burning villages all around. The Germans also seized livestock en masse. It's difficult to describe just how much we're getting hold of," mused Helmut P. "Every day some chickens, geese, rabbits, cows, pigs, and so on learned the hard way. Eggs, milk, honey are available en masse. Everything was burned out." Oberfeldwebel Georg S. of the 73rd Infantry Division wrote from the southern Ukraine on 22 November, "It isn't just the destruction of all important installations, which I can see the need for, that is carried out to the last detail. We also take all able-bodied men with us, for whenever the Russians recapture an area, they put the men to work to rebuild the roads and are therefore able to free up their own soldiers. The women join our retreat as well, as long as they're sprightly enough, so the Russian arrives in a virtually depopulated country, containing at most old women and military installations. Indeed, the scale of evacuation was as immense as the scale of destruction. In September 1943, for instance, Field Marshal von Küchler ordered the evacuation of 300,000 civilians between the front line and the Panzer line. In the event, Army Group North uprooted three times that number. By the following month, Army Group Center had evacuated 500,000 people. Perhaps 15% of the civilians whom the Germans took along with them, predominantly ethnic Germans, Wehrmacht auxiliaries and their families, went willingly. The rest did not. The Germans wanted them for their labor, whether in the Reich itself or for the Wehrmacht's fortifications on the Eastern Front. This meant not just tearing families from their homes, but also tearing parents from their children. For instance, in November 1943, the 383rd Infantry Division ordered that all able-bodied men between 16 and 65 and all women between 15 and 45 who did not have children under 15 were to be allocated to work details. In December, the Second Army stated that the population was fundamentally rejecting evacuation and would have to be forced. In May 1944, an order issued by Henning von Threskow, now a major general and chief of staff to the Second Army, stressed that unnecessary harshness was to be avoided, but that those who are of service age or working age who tried to escape from the selection are to be suspected as bandits. By now, this at least meant that they should be treated as POWs rather than shot, but sometimes the Germans shot them anyway. Such was the action of the refounded 6th Army, which in September 1943 reported executing 105 unwilling evacuees. Conditions on the march itself were often atrocious. An October 1943 report from the southern Ukraine described orphans and children crying out from cold and hunger, women crying because their men had been packed off for labor in the Reich, and stragglers often being shot. Many who could not move were dumped in makeshift camps where they died from the appalling conditions. In March 1944, under the jurisdiction of the 9th Army, 500 civilians who were unable to walk to the camps, including children, were shot. It is not clear who did the shooting, though a likely candidate would be the GFP. The GFP also shot thousands in the camps themselves, as did the camp guards. Even in this twilight stage of the German campaign in the Soviet Union, scorched earth, like the anti-partisan campaign before it, was driven by a fusion of military and economic necessity. During the autumn of 1943, thousands of tons of produce, machinery, and farming implements were brought back from the retreats. Cities such as Vitebsk and Mogilev were ransacked of their economic value. In March 1944, following orders to clear Vitebsk, the 3rd Panzer Army oversaw the evacuation of 23,000 people, all of whom were workers. Those who could not work were left in villages in the army rear area. In September 1943, the 4th Army issued orders to leave behind all families containing more than a fifth of family members who could not work. By December, presumably following discussion with German economic agencies, it had revised the limit to half of family members. 5 months later, Threskow himself signed a Second Army order stating that useless eaters are to be left to the enemy. Overall, the scorched earth campaigns of 1943 to 1944 remain a somewhat murky area of the German Army's war in the East, and indeed the fate of its victims in the camps is murkier still. What seems clear is that despite some flashes of humanity, the evacuations themselves were generally carried out in a brutally peremptory manner. Years of anti-Slavic prejudice, National Socialist conditioning, and brutalizing warfare in the East saw to that. So too, it seems, did soldiers' knowledge of what their own families were suffering at the hands of Allied strategic bombing, and the fear of what they and their families might yet suffer were Germany to be defeated. Manstein himself shared the sentiments of General Speidel in Greece, contending even after the war that the German scorched-earth measures bore no comparison to the terror bombing suffered by the civil population in Germany or what happened later in Germany's eastern territories. He also asserted that they would be dwarfed by what eastern Germany could expect to suffer at the hands of a savage invading Red Army. At least some hardened troops also seem to have derived a nihilistic sense of pleasure from the spectacle of so much destruction. In northwest Russia, Soviet sources claimed 20 cities and 3,135 villages were severely damaged by the Germans during their retreat. 90% of all industrial installations, 70% of agricultural equipment, 60% of collective farm barns and sheds, and 43% of the cattle population were destroyed or plundered. "A wonderful experience to witness a fire," wrote one soldier of the retreating 21st Infantry Division, "either of a house, or even better, an entire street front, a village, or even a city. Many people, I believe almost everyone, feel a perverse pleasure in the act of destruction, especially when they themselves are the creator of the destruction." It is perhaps ironic, then, that Manstein's post-war memoirs defended the Scorched Earth campaign by claiming that all the measures taken on the German side were conditioned by military necessity. Following its defeats in the spring and early summer of 1943, virtually the entire German army leadership lined up with Hitler in its determination to continue the fight in the hope of staving off Germany's national destruction. This was irrespective of the fact that individual generals differed over how best to do so. Any general who still believed that maneuver warfare could do anything more than delay the inevitable was as deluded as any who believed, as Hitler strongly tended to believe, that tenacious defense could stem the Allied tide long enough to bring a decisive turnaround in Germany's fortunes. Even before Hitler prioritized the West, the German army in the East was a declining force assailed by an ever more unstoppable Red Army. The blow that the Red Army inflicted on the Germans in the Ukraine emphatically announced this new reality. Most ominously, the Red Army possessed far more than a simple numerical advantage, for it had grown much more proficient in the kind of warfare in which the German army had hitherto considered itself the unsurpassed master. The Soviets were vastly helped by the Western Allies, whether through lend-lease or through the bombing of German industry. This in itself signified what the German army was now up against, an immensely powerful enemy coalition that it ultimately could not withstand. The German army's own ability to curb the Allied onslaught was further complicated by the rising profile of the Waffen-SS, even though there were ways in which the army also benefited from its rival. In what remained of the occupied rear, the army's frustration and desperation told in its anti-partisan and economic measures, both of which were fused during 1943 in the Dead Zone operations. Here, too, the SS acted as both rival and facilitator. Ultimately, however, the denouement in the occupied rear was also fast approaching. For the Soviet population, the worst confluence between occupation policy and military necessity was the colossal program of scorched earth operations that the retreating army executed. These were not carried out in an unreservedly savage manner, but they were a profoundly harsh, brutal business that inflicted copious misery. They indicated that both the army as a whole and many of its individual soldiers had fewer inhibitions about how harshly they treated the population at the end of the campaign in the Soviet Union than they had at its start. The main reason for this lay in the army's ever more severe interpretation of military necessity. But the derision much of the army felt towards eastern populations made it less inhibited still. Both motives in turn were buttressed by Nazi ideology, and, by now, a general indifference to the sufferings of occupied civilians caused by the knowledge of what German civilians were suffering under Allied bombs. Such was the callous, desperate mindset that animated so much of the army in this fifth year of war. Despite the calamities that beset it, the German army remained a cohesive fighting force until the 10 months between July 1943 and May 1944. The northern and central sectors of its front remained predominantly intact. Even Army Group South, with the Red Army raining down repeated blows upon it, managed to prevent its retreat from becoming a collapse. Not only that, even in the depths of the winter of 1943 to 1944, the Germans inflicted casualty rates upon the Red Army of between 20% and 25%. The German army's still pugnacious defense during this final phase of its campaign on the Soviet soil, then, begs the further question of how and why the Frontsoldat, the German front-line soldier, was able to endure. Chapter 19. The Eastern Front, 1943-1944. The Frontsoldat endures. By the spring of 1944, the Red Army had reached the Romanian border, almost reached the Carpathians in Poland, and pushed the Germans back 160 kilometers, 100 miles, west from Leningrad. Yet the Germans sold the ground dearly, and the Eastern Front did not cave in, despite ongoing losses to the Red Army, transfers of troops to other fronts, and stagnating German armaments output during the second half of 1943. The German Eastern Army, the Ostheer, increasingly resembled the metaphorical dead fish. The strategic head had rotted, but the tactical tail was very much intact. Its defensive techniques, its armoured capability, and above all the resilience of its troops, were all partly to thank for this. Both the German infantry and armour were beset by severe weaknesses in the field, but their numerous strengths brought some compensation. The Germans no longer had enough troops for real defence in depth along the entire front. Instead, they did their best to man a precariously thin forward defence line. They concentrated much of their remaining manpower on rivers, which gave them natural defence, and villages. Villages often controlled roads and provided troops with shelter from the elements while they constructed their bunkers. Generally, the Germans would hold on to strong points until the last minute, before retreating to rear defence lines in scattered sectors hastily constructed by pioneers. Civilians near the front line now faced new ordeals at the Germans' hands. They might be dragooned not only into building frontline fortifications, but also into clearing Soviet landmines. Such was the order issued by the 78th Assault Division for a daily routine that took place at 6 a.m. Paths that must be trodden by German troops are to be trampled daily by assembled inhabitants, including women and children, with cows, horses, and vehicles. Frontline divisions might also use civilians as human shields. The 35th Infantry Division put 33,000 people in a camp as hostages in a swamp near its front line, and sometimes brought them to the front if the Soviets attacked. Such conduct is not widely documented, but the fact that it happened was, like scorched earth, a sign of the brutalizing desperation that now animated many German army units. The most strongly fortified points along the German line were the cities that Hitler ordered turned into fortresses. Inspired, if that is the right word, by the Germans' experience in Stalingrad and other urban battles, Hitler hoped that German troops would be able to draw Red Army forces into battling for these cities and then bleed them white. However, the Germans did not possess the troops or resources to defend these cities properly. Such by now was the Allies' superiority in material and manpower in East and West that even a bloody, dogged defence could do no more than delay them. The human backbone of the German defence in the East was its infantry. "The hardest tasks fall to the infantry," wrote Wachtmeister Josef L. of the 129th Infantry Division in his letter of New Year's Day, 1944. "Day and night they stay out there. No trench system to ease their movements. A simple hole with some straw in it and a bit of tent canopy over the top serve as cover and accommodation simultaneously." The fact that the Eastern Front did not collapse completely is even more remarkable considering the range of perils and hardships the infantry faced. As in 1942, the infantryman's static war subjected him not only to Red Army attack, but also to daily miseries and primitive conditions. "It's quiet at the front at the moment," wrote Private Helmut P. of the 198th Infantry Division in June 1943. "We have few losses here, but many illnesses arise, malaria, dysentery, or other Russian illnesses. Typhus season is now over. This normally takes place in the early part of the year, because that's when one has the most lice and the blood is very susceptible to them. We all have to take Alibin against malaria every day. But despite that, this illness still pops up. Mosquitoes carry it. There are huge numbers of flies of every kind here. For the stagnant water of the Donets is a real brute." Even more alarming was the diminishing number of available troops. Between 1 July 1943 and 1 February 1944, the Ostheer's strength fell from just over 3.1 million men to just under 2.4 million. Hitler and the High Command went to ever more desperate lengths to try and make up the shortfall. For instance, Hitler's Directive 51 ordered the ever more extensive combing out of rear area units and the call-up of men born as early as 1888 and as recently as 1926. Captain Emmerich P. of Ortskommandantur II, 351, mused on the prospect of an army composed of old men and children. "I heard a good joke yesterday," he wrote in July 1943. "Hitler, Stalin, and Roosevelt have been in heaven a while. As they're hanging out together, they suddenly remember there was a war on Earth. They call Methuselah and instruct him to see if the war is still going on. After a while, Methuselah runs back to heaven in a sweat. 'What's wrong?' they ask him. Agitated and out of breath, he answers, 'Do you know, I was already halfway to Earth, and then I heard my age group was being called up too.'" The army relied increasingly upon raising troops from among occupied populations, including the Turkic peoples of the Crimea and the Caucasus, Cossacks and ethnic Germans from Poland, whose tenuous claims to German ethnicity concerned the army much less than the manpower they provided. By mid-1944, at least 13% of the army's manpower came from outside the Reich's borders. The morale and commitment of such troops often left much to be desired. The Wehrmacht also abandoned its ideological aversion to employing women. By the end of 1943, its various service branches together employed over 170,000 women as auxiliary communication staff. In order to get new recruits from the Reich to the front sooner, the army cut their basic training in Germany from 3 months to two. They were then transferred to their field units and spent several weeks being trained by their division's field replacement battalion before taking up frontline duty. But the sum of the military leadership's measures could not cover the army's losses, and it eventually had to reduce its division's establishment strength further. A first wave infantry division at the beginning of the war had comprised 17,000 men. Now, an infantry division's establishment strength was less than 11,000. Where possible, the army did not break up divisions that had been badly mauled, for that would give the enemy the satisfaction of having annihilated a German formation. But some divisions suffered losses so horrendous that they had to be refounded from scratch. Major Freiherr von Lersner of the OKH visited the 1st Panzer Army in November 1943. "In the power and ability of these men lies our superiority over the enemy," he wrote. "Every technical and organizational measure must be used to preserve them." But against such odds, there were painful limits to what the men could do. One soldier told Lersner, "As an infantryman, you feel thoroughly ashamed to have to constantly fall back before vermin such as this." Another proclaimed, "Defense is our ruin, attack our only salvation." In this situation, the quality of new arrivals, already on the slide in 1942, inevitably deteriorated further. At the end of 1942, an Army Ordnance Department liaison officer reported, "The moment they come under fire, the men from the reserves refuse to advance, and the whole burden of fighting goes to the older men, even more of whom are lost as a result. Over and over again, when the time comes to go into battle, young replacement troops are suddenly found to have a bad heart or flat feet or some other similar ailment." As this account attests, poor recruits lowered the survival chances of their more experienced comrades. The resentment veteran soldiers felt towards such recruits could be palpable. "A crappy load of kids," was how Corporal Waldo P. of the 5th Light Division described them. Unteroffizier Julfried K. of the 25th Panzer Grenadier Division wrote more sympathetically about the recruits' own survival chances. "The replacements we received during these days of battle have been blown away on the wind. Just boys, 18, 19 years old, all still too young." As with the rank and file, so were the officers and NCOs. Throughout 1943, an average of 150 officers were killed each day, and so many experienced NCOs were lost that few could be spared for further officer training. In theory, the shortage of officers opened the door to all comers, regardless of social and educational background, and gave them even greater opportunity to advance on merit. This was, of course, exactly how Hitler wanted things. In January 1943, with looming disaster at Stalingrad and potential disaster in Tunisia, Hitler issued a further basic order declaring that he wanted officers who were strong in will, ready for duty, and firm in a crisis, who will lead in a hard, unflinching manner when the decisive hour comes. One drawback of Hitler's desire to create a meritocratic, authentically National Socialist officer corps was that, with no minimum time limit on how rapidly officers of the right character could be promoted, they were often promoted beyond their real ability before they could fully prove themselves. Eventually, the army sought to impose probation periods. For instance, an officer would need to have been a captain for at least 18 months before he could become a battalion commander. But in reality, officer losses were so high that such stipulations were often ignored. Increasingly, promotion was based on a box-ticking exercise designed to establish their character, ideological convictions, and racial purity, rather than their military abilities. In Dennis Showalter's words, By late 1942, any German over 16 could become an army officer if he served acceptably at the front, demonstrated the proper character, believed in the Nazi cause, and was racially pure. The final three criteria were as much a matter of square-filling as rigorous investigation. In view of all this, it is no surprise that defeatism was on the increase. Divisions with an unblemished record now regularly report cases of men deserting or absent without leave, reported the Army Ordnance Department's liaison officer at the end of 1942. The day after tomorrow, wrote Josef L. in April 1943, another 20 men are to be sent to the infantry. You should see their faces as if they were going straight to their graves. Writing in November of that year, Lance Corporal Franz T. of the 4th Mountain Division was less articulate. We really now have no idea where we go from here. Yes, this hideous war, no one knows how it will end. An SD report of October 1943 commented, "It is striking that the now growing number of those on leave from the Eastern Front are coming out with pessimistic views, while a few months ago they still had an almost unchangeable confidence and complete faith in the triumph of our arms. Lately, men on leave have also spread an increasing number of unfavorable reports on the relationship between officers and men." Some soldiers sought refuge in drink. In August 1943, Corporal Ferdinand M. of the 167th Infantry Division wrote, "There's a real to-do with us at the moment. Everything's in chaos. Tonight I had to throw up something unbelievable. We'd cleared out a supply dump and found a few barrels of beer there. We got drunk, it was really warm, and the consequences followed. I'm really done in today. I'd better stop now." More serious breakdowns in discipline were extremely rare, but not unheard of. "Today," wrote Lance Corporal Helmut P. on 26 August, "the 1st Battalion beat up its commander so badly that he needed medical help. He's a bastard, but the Lancer weren't going to take his tyranny any more. Please keep this to yourself." The infantry did not face the Red Army alone, of course. As Inspector General of Armoured Troops, General Guderian partially weaned himself off his predilection for tank-heavy formations by conceding that the Germans must now support their infantry by concentrating much of their armour as anti-tank support for it. Nevertheless, Legion failings also blighted the German panzer force. Armoured fighting vehicle production might be increasing, but Allied bombing checked that increase. Such were the effects of this, combined with battlefield losses, that by October 1943, the training section of Guderian's General Inspectorate estimated that an average panzer division now contained only a few panzers and one panzer grenadier battalion, with a corresponding amount of artillery and trucks. Moreover, incomplete training debilitated panzer formations just as it did infantry formations. Recruits were now being rushed to the front more and more quickly and given hasty remedial training by their frontline units. The training section conveyed the effects of these and other failings in a memorandum that month. Panzers in counterattack faced increasingly well-dug-in positions, bristling with anti-tank guns, minefields, and natural obstacles. In one day, the report stated, a panzer brigade of 300 battle-ready tanks was whittled down to 12. It lost 100 tanks to the minefields alone. They also faced an enemy superior in material and numbers, and consistently able to throw in new reserves, while the Germans themselves lacked the numbers needed to exploit any initial successes. One panzer regiment had had to fight for 3 weeks without a break, then destroy many of its tanks before they fell into Soviet hands. The Germans lost even more panzers needlessly because of the failings of non-armoured units that were supposed to be supporting them. For instance, one newly established panzer section had been dispersed among different corps and divisions, and lacked any on-the-spot technical help. It even lacked enough explosives to blow up its tanks if they stopped moving. Within days, reliant on non-armoured units that apparently had no grasp of combined arms warfare, its 96 battle-ready panthers had been reduced to 8. The training section did acknowledge that the tigers and panthers were on the way to overcoming their growing pains, and that equipping them with, respectively, 88mm and 75mm guns was helping to even the score. "There is no doubt," it wrote, "that the new German panzers are far superior to previous Russian and Anglo-American models. How they are used, though, is crucial." And yet, although Guderian himself achieved a great deal as Inspector General, he too was partly responsible for the Panzer's travails. Believing deep down that only tanks could fight other tanks, he did not energetically promote the development of self-propelled artillery to protect and support Panzer formations. Listening to this, one may wonder how the Ostheer held on at all. The first foundation of its resilience was economic.